From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a health crisis means Sergio Marchionne is no longer the head of Fiat Chrysler.
His lasting legacy will be that he saved Chrysler and saved Fiat. He saved Fiat before he even saved Chrysler, put the two together.
We'll talk with gubernatorial candidate Brian Kelly, our lieutenant governor, about his run for governor and focus on improving special ed.
The practices inside of schools and the way that kids with disabilities have been treated for generations is absolutely appalling, and that's why I've made this my mission in life.
The rebellion that erupted in Grand Rapids this week in 1967.
There had been a lot of tension within the community. There had been unhappiness with police and neighborhood relations.
And the outbreak that gave the world Legionnaire's disease. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Big automotive news to start with today, both involving change. Michelle Krebs, Detroit-based executive and analyst for Autotrader.com, is here with us about these stories. Now, Michelle, we've heard changes in the North American International Auto Show were coming, and now the Detroit Auto Dealers Association has made it official. So what is starting in 2020?
So in 2020, we'll no longer have to deal with the frigid cold of January, especially for charity preview night when we wear our high heels and such. The show is moving to June. In addition to it moving date-wise, they're basically reinventing it. I think of it as kind of an auto show that will involve the entire city.
So kind of going from the, all right, we're all going to troop into Cobo and walk around and look at vehicles that we've been doing for decades and in our snow boots. So now we can wear flip-flops and what, go outside?
Right. It appears they're looking at doing things like test drives outside, a street festival with concerts and such. Something that will be more encompassing of the entire city and more expansive in terms of what an auto show means. You know, one of the big upcoming trends will be the launch of autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars, and so I would not be at all surprised to see if there's a heavy emphasis on that when this happens in June 2020, because by then there will be some of these out on the road. I mean, you know, the big story is that the auto companies have been complaining, one, that it's in the winter, but also that it's very expensive to do events at auto shows, and they all try to outdo each other, and they compete for attention. So they've been going elsewhere. They're going places like CES and different places. So this is a way for Detroit to respond in a fresh way.
So give us a sense of some of the places where this kind of auto show street festival might be happening.
Well, certainly Campus Martius will play a big role in it, and Cobo will be part of it. So it'll be a lot of automotive activities for a stretch of time in lots of different venues around the city.
Now we want to go to the news that broke over the weekend. Just what happened to force Sergio Marchionne to step down immediately as the head of Fiat Chrysler?
Well, Mr. Marchionne had shoulder surgery, I believe, in late June, and something went awry. He had complications from that, and the board of directors met in an emergency session on Saturday, and he stepped down from that position, and he was replaced by Mike Manley, who's been the top executive at Fiat Chrysler and mostly in charge of Jeep. So it's a sad situation.
I'm sure to have something happen that suddenly is pretty rare.
Well, and in particular, since he was going to retire shortly, I just got back from Italy in early June, where Marchionne and his top team had laid out the plan for the next 5 years, and he insisted, I'm not telling you who the successor is, we'll do that later. You know, they had a very planned rollout for when that would happen, and then, you know, life takes funny turns.
It does. So what's the take on Mike Manley, on his successor? Is there a sense he'll stay the course charted out by Marchionne?
Right. I was at the five-year plan presentation, and Mike Manley was by far, you know, front and center. So it was kind of obvious that he was at least a top candidate. He is different from Mr. Marchionne, as most are, pretty low-key, but a really solid choice, very logical, you know, so it won't change things tremendously. He was part of developing the next five-year plan, so he has, you know, a lot invested in that. I think his appointment is being received well by dealers, by employees. He's very well-liked.
Michelle, would there be a Fiat Chrysler today in 2018 without Marchionne?
No. in a word. No, I think, you know, his lasting legacy will be that he saved Chrysler and saved Fiat. He saved Fiat before he even saved Chrysler, put the two together, and came out of the Great Recession, most, you know, when everybody else was saying, just let Chrysler go. And what they have been able to do with Chrysler on a shoestring and without much to work with has been pretty miraculous.
Michelle Krebs, executive and analyst for AutoTrader.com. Michelle, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Were the children of Flint poisoned? That word has been used by activists and journalists describing just what happened as a result of switching Flint to improperly treated drinking water from the Flint River. But in an opinion piece published in today's New York Times, Dr. Hernan Gomez and his co-author Kim Dietrich argue saying Flint's kids have been poisoned unjustly stigmatizes their generation. Dr. Gomez is an associate professor with the University of Michigan and an emergency medicine pediatrician and medical toxicologist with the Hurley Medical Center in Flint. Dr. Gomez, this editorial is titled, The Children of Flint Were Not Poisoned. Why do you say that word is toxic?
Because poisoned in the context of lead means permanent brain damage. We have no reason to believe the children had permanent brain damage. When I refer to permanent brain damage, we're talking about an entire generation of children with decreased IQs, with an increased tendency for ADHD, and also increased criminal behavior. And I think it's a stigma to say that based on a crossing of over the reference value of 5 micrograms per deciliter.
And explain to the public what that means, the CDC reference
the
value.
The CDC reference value simply means that it's a reference value. The CDC won't even call it a threshold value of concern. They drop that. It is simply a value of which the CDC recommends that a child or a population that their housing or the environment around them be investigated. It was never meant to be a definitive term of poisoned.
It's an alarm bell.
We can call it an alarm bell, but it was even an alarm bell that was meant to start looking more closely at a population.
And I know in your editorial in the New York Times, you point out concerns that there are other areas in Michigan where lead is a problem, big trouble spots. You write about the fact, for example, in Detroit, 8.8% of children, 8.1% of kids in Grand Rapids, 14% of children in Highland Park, all that percentage surpassed the CDC reference level. And you say Flint is at 2.4%.
Flint is at 2.4%. I view this as a public health success. There are many areas of the state that would envy that number. Grand Rapids is currently at 8%. Detroit is currently at over 8%. Mm-hmm. Lenawee County is 6.1% south of us here. Highland Park is an astounding 14% above this reference value. I would prefer not even to use the word poison for them. I would simply say that these are trouble spots, that there should be an investigation as to why this is happening, and perhaps resources should be made open to them as well.
And you've done a lot of studies. You've done the long-term studies looking at blood lead levels in children in Flint.
Myself and my colleagues are the only group that have done any long-term study evaluating Flint. We went back to 2006 through 2016, inclusive of the water switch.
And you say there is no scientific evidence to support the belief that this generation of children in Flint are lost.
Every study that has looked into intellectual deficits of lead in children have actually used lead levels. They have never used the CDC reference value. Therefore, this study is concentrated on lead levels. We also used the same statistical techniques as the CDC as well. What we found is during the year of the water crisis that there was a 0.11 increase, 0.11 microgram per deciliter. I hate to throw terms like that, but those are the units in children. We also found that years prior to that, between 2010 and 2011, there was a 0.12 microgram per deciliter increase randomly. So we found that in analyzing all these years, that the actual increase in Flint children could not be differentiated from what occurs randomly year to year. We're not claiming that the coincidence of the increase in the reference range may be due to the water, but we're trying to place it in context. It was no higher than what has occurred randomly in Flint in the past.
How do you think this narrative has taken hold, the poisoned narrative?
Well, I think it's unfortunate. I believe that even prior to the Flint water crisis, that in the Flint area, that there has been a great deal of distrust of government already. Flint has a history both from, I will say, industry, from public health, economics, and for other reasons, has learned to distrust government, and perhaps for good reason. So to go through another narrative, and by the way, I'm not going to repeat the missteps which brought us to this place, but brought me here to speak with you right now, but these were not fair. However, the narrative that Flint children have been poisoned is an untrue narrative. It needs to be corrected. I think it's wonderful that resources have been brought to the children of Flint, as I do think that resources should be brought to all the children in Michigan who have been exposed to lead. But let's be very, very clear here. To use the word lead poison is to insinuate that the children of Flint are going to have less ability to go into professional degrees, less ability to perhaps enter college, increased criminal behavior in a town that already has increased violent criminal activity. So I think it's unfair. I think it's an unfair stigmatization, and it should be dropped because it is simply untrue.
Did you write this New York Times editorial for journalists and activists, or for whom?
I wrote it for everybody. I wrote it for the entire leadership of the New York Times. It's meant to be thought provocative. I believe that the ongoing narrative of, quote, poisoned children is, I don't see this as going away anytime soon. The narrative is just to allow people to think this through, to force thought.
And to someone who feels you are somehow trying to minimize the suffering that happened in Flint, how do you respond to that?
That's absolutely untrue. So my response to this is simply that numbers are numbers. I am simply analyzing numbers and telling folks what these numbers show. And the numbers show the elevations of lead were no different than what had occurred randomly over the past decade. The reaction, in my view, should be that one of reassurance, that your child there, maybe perhaps they're listening to you, and perhaps your child's playing in front of you that's 7 years old or 8 or 9 or 10 years old, that child is still going to go to college. That child has not had brain damage. I've met the Flint children, and they're capable of pretty much anything, and they still are.
Dr. Hernan Gomez, emergency medicine pediatrician and toxicologist with the University of Michigan and Hurley Medical Center. His editorial, co-authored with Kim Diedrich, is in today's New York Times. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you, Cynthia Canty. It's a pleasure.
In about 20 minutes, we will hear from Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly as we continue checking in with the 2018 candidates for governor. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Public health officials report a spike in cases of Legionnaires' disease this summer, both nationally and here in Michigan. It has been 42 years since the first outbreak of the mystery disease that eventually became known as Legionellosis, and it took some serious medical detective work. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is with us now. So 42 years ago this week, the Pennsylvania chapters of the American Legion hold their state convention in Philadelphia. How many were there and where'd they stay?
There was at least 2,000 members, and it was at one of those grand old hotels, the Bellevue Stratford Hotel on Broad Street, which is still there. And, you know, with the big lobbies and all the convention rooms, it was one of the perfect places to hold a convention of this size.
And that was going on this week, 42 years ago. So what was the first sign of trouble?
Well, in retrospect, it probably all started on July 23rd. But there was a group of vets who started reporting to the VA hospital in Philadelphia to see a doctor there named Franklin, Dr. Sidney Franklin. And they all had atypical, what's called atypical forms of pneumonia. It didn't fit patterns of, say, bacterial pneumonia. They were coughing a lot. They clearly had fluid in their lungs. They were short of breath. And some of them had extremely high fevers. And within a week or two of the people who were presenting to Dr. Franklin, a couple of them died. And so that's when he decided, you know, I don't know what's going on here. I don't have any blood test that is telling me what's going on. I don't have any x-ray test that will tell me exactly what type of pneumonia this is. And even the antibiotics I'm using, they're not working all that well. So he called in the CDC. And the CDC, of course, went on the case. The Epidemiological Intelligence Service, as they call it, they came in with the shoe leather epidemiology.
and that was the digging. And when you stop and you think of the optics of vets getting sick and dying during the big bicentennial summer celebration.
Yeah, in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. So that grabs some attention, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard for people to remember today how big the bicentennial was and even the lead up. Remember, it was on CBS, I believe, they had a bicentennial minute every night.
They did.
And if you were a great TV watcher, as I was at the time, you watched them every night. And then there was, you know, the whole build up to that summer. And so the optics looked quite bad. There was another issue too. Dr. Franklin worried there was a recent case in February of a strange form of flu that killed a couple of servicemen at Fort Dix in New Jersey in February, and that was called swine flu.
Oh, and I remember the big swine flu buildup.
Exactly. So there's the big swine flu buildup in the Gerald Ford administration, and his CDC director, David Sensor, who was a Michigander from Grand Rapids, geared up for that massive vaccine program. By the way, an epidemic that has been referred to as the epidemic that never was.
Never was.
So that created a whole set of different optics. So you have all this stuff going on, bicentennial, Philadelphia, the
veterans,
and some weird disease, some weird infectious
disease. And people
disease.
Are dying.
And people are dying.
So ultimately, how many got sick? How many died?
182 people got sick and 29 died.
All right, so we talk about the shoe leather. What kind of detective work happened? How did they crack the case?
Well, it's fascinating. They went all over the hotel and they checked the walls and the wallpaper and the elevators and the stairwell for some type of contaminant. They looked for people who might have been ill. My favorite is that the pitchers that were serving the vets their Bloody Marys may have had some cadmium in it, and cadmium poisoning can somewhat resemble influenza-like symptoms. No go.
They were even thinking birds, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, you know, they were looking at there were various shut-ins at this hotel that lived there permanently, and somebody said, I heard a parakeet, and parakeets can spread a disease called psittacosis, which is also flu-like in its symptomatology. So everything was a zero. Everything.
Until
there was a Christmas party down at CDC in Atlanta, and there was a microbiologist named Joseph McDade, and one of his superior officers sort of razzed him, you know, you guys can't figure this out. You're the CDC, you can't figure it out. So it was over Christmas break, and he holed himself up in his laboratory with a lot of guinea pigs and a lot of blood and tissue samples from those people who got ill. And he did this and he did that, and he finally discovered a new bacterium, which he named Legionella pneumophila. I can never say that. Pneumophila. and it was a new bacterium. And it was discovered to be something that would grow and propagate in stagnant water, in heating, cooling, mostly cooling systems, air conditioning systems. And it's a new disease because when you think about the advent of air conditioning and the advent of skyscrapers in terms of how many tall buildings there were, the 1970s is sort of that tipping point where you would see something like that. They probably saw a few before, but they didn't recognize it.
So that aha moment sent them down the right path.
Right. And then they figured out they needed different types of antibiotics that would break through the cell wall of this bacterium and treat it far better. And they also had to incorporate far better inspection and maintenance procedures for various air conditioning or climate control systems. That said, as you mentioned in the lead up, there are still buildings that they don't check all that well. And probably the cases that we're seeing today are from such buildings.
And certainly it played a role in the Flint water disaster.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, stagnant water, old pipes, not a good thing. We've known this for 100 years when you think about malaria and things like that. But there are other bacteria that like to grow and do their stuff.
But just stop and think, there's probably an entire generation of folks who are not old enough, if I dare say, who remember that summer 42 years ago when it all began.
It was so scary. And, you know, not many diseases are named after a convention, but this one was.
University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today marks the 51st anniversary of the 1967 uprising in Detroit, the rebellion or riot that left 43 people dead and thousands of buildings in the city destroyed. Michigan Radio did a deep dive into the history and legacy of that event last year, and you can find all of those stories by heading to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. This year, we focus on the smaller rebellion that started 2 days later in Grand Rapids. For an historical overview of what happened in Grand Rapids July 25th, 1967, we turn to Matthew Daly, Associate Professor of History at Grand Valley State University. Matthew, set the scene for us. What was life like if you were an African American living in Grand Rapids in the 1960s?
The African American community in Grand Rapids during the 1960s had grown dramatically in terms of size since before the Second World War, yet it was still largely located in the southeast part of the city along Division Avenue and around Hall Street and the like. It's an area that was in many ways very segregated away from the rest of the city. It was kind of a city within a city. The growth of the community had come from the opportunity for new manufacturing positions. For a long time, the furniture industry in Grand Rapids had only really had a small black community working within it. But with the growth of auto parts and other sorts of industries, it drew a larger number of migrants from the South to the area, and also from Detroit. People moved around to different opportunities. General Motors had a large stamping plant along 36th Street. So it was a growing community, but it was still largely isolated. In many ways, there were only a limited number of opportunities for retail, for education. And that was a real point of contention. Paul Phillips, the head of the Grand Rapids Urban League, a very significant figure in the city's history, had really sort of identified that all the way in the 1950s. And it was not really something that just sort of popped up overnight.
So take us to July 25th, 1967. What was the spark that set off these 3 days of disorder?
That's a really challenging sort of question. It depends on who you ask. There's several versions of what really got it started. The first is that there was a report of African American youths breaking into a car and the police came. There was a scuffle and a young man fell and was injured, and therefore it drew a crowd. There's another that young men were throwing sort of rocks and stones at buildings and at white-owned businesses. There's another that there was a traffic stop. And really, at least for me, it's less that there was some sort of spectacular event that really started it. It triggered a response that people just got tired. This had gone on quite a bit. There had been a lot of tension within the community. There had been unhappiness with police and neighborhood relations. There had been an effort to start to address that. There had been a very strong sort of a real unease and a clear definition of real estate discrimination, not allowing African Americans to move into different neighborhoods, that students were being steered. There was a discussion about desegregation of the schools that had the city pretty tense. There had been some resistance to doing so. There is also a recognition that there are limited retail and job opportunities, especially for young African American men and women in the city, because this is the time that the mall sort of phenomena began, that neighborhoods began to lose their retail businesses. They would not hire African Americans, or there were many stores that were being shuttered along Division Avenue. There was a full-scale transition, as in many places. And so all these things sort of feed together, and the police are the most visible part of city government in a sense that they're being hassled. Paul Phillips had warned against that sort of thing, that there was a real hostility. There was a lot of tinder lying around for that spark. It's during the time of the long, hot summers. There's a lot of unrest.
The headlines coming out of Detroit at about the same time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, everybody's on edge. This is the time when you've also got television that can tell people what's going on. You can see it with a lot of immediacy. And there's the people that come out. There's a series of fires that are started. There's arrests. There's a lot of property damage. In Grand Rapids, there's less looting. There's more property damage that you really take it out on the businesses and the symbols that tell people that they don't have an opportunity, that there's schools that aren't really serving the community with a high-level education. There have been a lot of reports that outline that. The businesses that wouldn't hire African Americans, businesses that were white-owned that wouldn't serve African Americans or hire them. There's a lot of anger, and it runs the fire department ragged.
So the fire department is certainly busy putting out fires. Did we have National Guard brought in? I mean, in Detroit, the 101st Airborne wound up coming in. What about in Grand Rapids?
No, they did not come in with the National Guard. What ended up with was about 220 some state troopers, other area local police departments. One of the things was that the city manager, Henry Neighbors, told the police chief, William Johnson, they said, don't mess around. They had to use a reasonable amount of force and not take any guff because this one's not going to get out of hand like Detroit. And the city had already sort of begun to think about that there was a real situation that could happen. I always sort of think it's sort of interesting that Detroit always is sort of portrayed as, oh, we didn't know it was going to happen, which is really not true. And it's really not true for Grand Rapids. People here, you know, in the city leadership knew that there was a lot of unrest. One of the big things that the city did that really sort of helped was that there had already been something called the task force. There was an outside consultancy that paired African-American community members with Grand Rapids police officers and sort of did role-playing and sort of relationship building. The police officers who were paired with the community members had visited the neighborhoods as civilians in civilian clothing, not as police officers, and sort of knew around. And the task force was deployed, and its members said that they did a lot of good, that they were able to head off a lot. In addition, there were a large number of injuries, but there is no deaths, amazingly. There's no sort of monumental events such as the Algiers Motel or other sorts of really brutal violence. There's a few reports of sniping. There's even questions that I've read whether or not they actually were sniping or people were just sort of imagining it. But it did not get nearly as out of hand, both between the efforts of, you know, community leaders, the police, and especially the community itself that did not come out and really sort of engage in that. The disturbance was under 1,000 people, and really a lot of people stayed in their homes, and in no small part because they knew the community members, that when these policemen arrived with these young men, they weren't viewed as sort of coming in as external force. They knew these people. They had a rapport. They were able to work with the community, and these young men could go out and really had that sort of trust and that credibility with the African-American community to help try to defuse that situation. The police officers themselves could speak to their colleagues and say, yeah, this isn't necessary. There's not a lot of sniping, and really keep the sort of out of control sense that it could really spiral into.
Over those 3 days, where in Grand Rapids did most of the disturbance happen?
Most of the disturbance is in the area along Division Avenue, around Hall Street, up to the north and the south. It's a very visible disturbance. It's in the sort of that large commercial district. It's a commercial backed up by residential areas. At that time, was a lot of transition in the retail area. And it's in the southeast part of the city, south of downtown. It's a relatively confined area. Unlike Detroit, where it spread very quickly throughout the city, in Grand Rapids, the police were able to close off the major arteries. They stopped the freeway and really took very proactive steps, both locally and at a distance, and with the task force, could really move into the area quickly with both what you would call overwhelming force, but not with overwhelming violence. It was a sense more of to try to keep people from wandering around, and if people would look outside, they would see the police. They would maybe be visited or stopped by a task force members who said, yeah, it's really not worth it, don't go out, to really calm things quickly.
What changed in Grand Rapids after this uprising?
It really started a series of discussions about what was going on. It forced the city's leadership, who had already been aware of it, to really try to wrestle with this more. It also engaged things such as the Model Cities program from the federal government to begin to develop more African-American community leaders, that this was an issue that could not be ignored, that the white community was going to have to address it. In a very controversial move, it meant an effort at school desegregation, which led to the closure of the increasingly African-American majority South High School, which had been at that time the city's most diverse high school. That had some pretty mixed outcomes, you know, leading to some clashes between students at Union High School on the west side when there was integration. It was a really difficult set of discussions, but it also meant that community members were now increasingly listened to, for better, for worse. Did it solve all the problems? No, it unfortunately did not, but it also meant that it also didn't fester or get swept under the rug quite as easily as other cities who just sort of said, well, we don't really want to see this problem. Grand Rapids did try to take more steps to address it, some which were more successful, others which were not, or at least were very controversial and left some pretty unhappy feelings in the area.
When you look at Detroit, Matthew Daly, especially some of the areas where most of the violence during that uprising happened, it's an area of the city still struggling to move on 50 years later. How do you think that compares to Grand Rapids in 2018?
Very much like Detroit, there are many areas that are still struggling with issues of quality housing, for employment opportunities, for recreation. That remains a challenge. For Grand Rapids, there was generally, even though there was a lot of looting and fires, there was far less physical damage. So when you go to those neighborhoods, many of those buildings are still standing. Some of them are not being used, but others are being redone or try to be adapted. Grand Rapids has experienced a massive, real change in the city's fabric, especially in the downtown and the west side of the city, with issues of affordable housing and population demographic changes. Down Division Avenue, there are some changes that are going on as development spreads down from downtown to the north. And so there are still a lot of challenges, but in many areas, if you go through, these are places that have a great deal of potential. They still have vibrant communities. They have churches, strong community groups, strong organizations. And these are places that, while they face a great many challenges, are very interesting places. When I go there, they're always welcoming. They're eager to talk history. They engage. They work with my students very excitedly. They're happy to work with us. And I think that's really exciting.
Grand Valley State University historian Matthew Daly. Thanks so much, Matthew.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Later in the week, we continue exploring the 1967 Grand Rapids uprising, turning to people who lived through it. Dan Gross, for instance, who worked as a probation officer at the time.
There were concerns about economic conditions, housing conditions, health conditions. All those kinds of things were at the forefront of the thoughts of people within the community.
We'll hear from Dan Gross and other Grand Rapids residents on Wednesday, the 51st anniversary of the uprising in their city. You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's primary is just a couple of weeks away on August the 7th. With us now, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, who is seeking the Republican nomination. Lieutenant Governor, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
We're going to start with the environment. Garrett Ellison of MLive recently reported that a Department of Environmental Quality employee named Robert Delaney wrote a 93-page report that spelled out his very, very deep concerns about per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS. Now we know about it. He was warning of a significant exposure to Michigan citizens and ecosystems and spelled out 15 recommendations for a state response. And that was 6 years ago, and that alarm was largely ignored. And we know now, as of last November, Governor Snyder created the PFAS Action Response Team, MPART. And now the state has a PFAS effort underway. But how do you feel about the fact that 6 years passed since that report and that warning?
You know, what is truly extraordinary is that Michigan is one of just three states still that is keeping this nationwide problem or making this nationwide problem a priority. We were pretty surprised to learn when the issues arose here that there weren't even any federal regs, only guidelines on this in terms of what acceptable levels are. So I think what it really came down to is just a matter of the areas that are highly regulated and had regulations on are the ones that get the most priority. And for whatever reason, even to this day, Cynthia, there is not a federal EPA standard on what the appropriate levels are, what the safe levels are for PFAS. We've had to develop this these regulations here in Michigan specific regulations, but military bases and airports all across the country, those areas potentially and probably have these same problems. And so just dealing with it as aggressively as possible is important.
But does it bother you that 6 years passed? I guess I'm wondering, what would you say to people who are now finding out that they may have been drinking that contaminated water for all those years?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's what's really upsetting is that there is no standard. So it's like the idea of you've got this report that comes out for a substance that the EPA didn't even feel it was necessary to even have a standard. And so I think that's really the difference. We find ourselves with having to develop the science in the first place to even determine, like, what is a safe level? What's the level when an alarm bell should ring? There's no consensus on that. So that's the, you know, Michigan is on the front edge, amazingly still on the front edge of this compared to other states around the country. And I think that eventually everybody else will catch on, but this is something that is a big, big problem. And we put substantial resources into standing up the testing labs and doing the finding out how big the problem is and where it is. And the thing is, the rest of the nation is going to really benefit from the work that we do here, because it's going to show them the way to figuring out what are the issues in their areas too.
I think to some you think of the DEQ response, and it may bring for people to mind the response of state officials when people in Flint were trying to convince them that something was wrong with the water. We remember the MDEQ spokesman saying everyone worried about Flint water can just relax. And it took citizen activists and Dr. Mona, Dr. Edwards, the EPA's Miguel Del Toro to get the state to admit the water had been poisoned. What do you say as you're out on the campaign trail to people who, when they think of the Snyder administration, immediately Flint comes to mind?
Well, first of all, obviously there are huge problems at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, failures at every single level of government. One of the important lessons I think to take out of Flint is when people say they have a problem, the default should be just to believe them, right? I mean, and maybe it's a misunderstanding, or maybe it's a difference of opinion on things, but still to stay at the table and get those things resolved. And so I decided that, as opposed to everybody else looking back, because listen, there's no shortage of people that like to look backward, point fingers, you know, cast blame and to fight and argue about the past. I moved my office to Flint. I'm not in the chain of command for emergency managers, so I felt I had an opportunity to go to Flint and be and just work on the future. Didn't have any, you know, part in the decisions of the past, so I could just be with people shoulder to shoulder, roll up my sleeves, and work on infrastructure.
And with all that work you've done in Flint, Lieutenant Governor Calley, and you put a lot of time on the ground in Flint. What lessons from Flint and that response would you take into the governor's office should you be elected?
Two things. I mean, we have a lot of information now looking back. The two main lessons. First is, when people say they have a problem, default to believing them, right? That's number one. And it's a basic premise I think we should go into, even when the experts disagree, even when the experts say, you know, actually, they don't, there's not really a problem, but they don't understand. Now stay at the table and resolve it. The other thing is, don't let the bureaucracy get away with technical answers to plain questions. You know, so if you were to ask somebody, as did get asked, you know, hey, scientists in the bureaucracy in the federal level or the state level, people say they have a problem with water in Flint. Is it okay? Is it safe? And they say, well, according to the most recent samples of Tier 1 sites, the test results show that the lead results are within the federal lead and copper rule. Now, that kind of sounds like they said yes, but they didn't really say yes, did they? I mean, is the lead and copper rule the right rule in the first place? Were the samples done properly and correctly? Maybe it's still under the limit, but are the trends looking good or bad? Is it trending in the wrong direction? There's a lot of additional questions that should be asked in those situations. And for most of us who aren't scientists, you know, plain questions, we have to make sure that plain questions get plain answers.
Continuing on an environmental note, the state is now taking public comments on that independent risk analysis of Enbridge's Line 5. Dr. Guy Meadows and his team at Michigan Tech calculated the damage a worst-case scenario would have on the Great Lakes. As much as 400 miles of shoreline could be harmed, and the cost to Michigan could be nearly $2 billion. What do you think should be done about Line 5?
We'll shut it down. And the nice thing is that there's a we did a feasibility study. You know, what are the other alternatives? Because you still need to get oil to refineries, and obviously shipping it by truck is not a feasible alternative. And tunneling far below the bed of the Great Lakes, you know, a dry tunnel where you could walk through it and do visual inspections on the outside, but having it, you know, 100 feet below the lake bed is a feasible alternative. And the thing is, Line 5 is in the water there, but there's actually many lines that run through there. And while they're not oil lines, they have coolant fluids and things in them. Why not put them all into one tunnel? And all these companies, you know, they get the benefit of a line so they can pay for it. But ultimately, we know now that there's a feasible alternative, and I believe we need to start moving toward that right now.
Now, environmental groups will point to the fact that could take 10 years. Can we afford to risk that for 10 years while this process gets decided on and in the engineering and the building of that tunnel done? Can we risk that?
I don't think that, first of all, it doesn't have to take that long. I would definitely call on the partners in the federal government to step up that work. I mean, everything that requires federal permits does seem to take a long time, but it doesn't have to. Number two, in the meantime, I am advocating for additional safeguards. So first of all, the reporting requirements have been stepped up, and in the meantime, passing the regs on ships going through, and you know, an anchor hook or an anchor strike is really the main risk that was identified and something that could cause a problem.
And something that happened this year.
It happened this year, and thankfully it didn't. It only was superficial damage to the line, but who knows? I mean, that's the thing. And so I'm envisioning a system like air traffic control. Every single airport in the state and the nation, before an airplane can land, they have to radio in. Am I good to go? Can we land? I'm picturing then why not when freighters go through there, freighters that have the type of anchors that could go that deep and are heavy and could cause damage, before you're clear to go through, is your anchor up? Yep, anchor's up. Okay, you can go through. You know, that sort of thing. I think that there are, we don't have to overcomplicate it. You know, sometimes the low-tech answer is the best answer. In the meantime, while we're finding the other, I think we already have found the other alternative, but while we're making the other alternative happen.
Lieutenant Governor Kelly, last week we learned that Michigan is the only state in the nation that needs federal intervention after it failed to meet federal special education requirements. What do you think's going on here?
Well, I'm so thankful to see the finally some attention to this area. I felt like a voice in the wilderness for the last 8 years on it. There's so much attention on general education, but not on special education. And so as I put the task force together to improve special education, I mean, Cynthia, we had to start with, you're not allowed to lock kids up in seclusion rooms or tie them up with restraints in non-emergency situations. That's when we first started, that's how bad it was. And even then, we're still, the practices inside schools. So while the test results in that are obviously very concerning, unfortunately, that is not the worst of it. I mean, the practices inside of schools and the way that kids with disabilities have been treated for generations is absolutely appalling. And that's why I've made this my mission in life. So we've made we outlawed restraint and seclusion practices, and we also went forward with, state supportive early on for early identification, hopefully kids that don't need to go into special education, and then also positive behavior interventions and supports that the trainers helping schools develop better practices. So I view this as there are two steps to it. We have to help schools with behavior management, and that's the area that if you don't have behaviors in a good place, kids can't learn. And so there are two steps to this process, and I'm really focusing intensely on that first step of helping schools be more effective with behavior management so that kids could even have access to the curriculum in the first place.
Lieutenant Governor Kelly, I think it's probably an understatement to say that the atmosphere in this country in 2018 is, to say the least, polarized. If you become our governor, do you think you can build consensus and not only work across the aisle, but also be a leader for more than the base?
I have been a consensus builder the whole time. If you look at the work that I do and the way that I do the work, I think the reason why I don't get as many invitations to come on shows like this is because I'm not an in-your-face, confrontational kind of a person, right? It's not as entertaining, maybe, but I am effective in getting things done and making it happen. And the only way I can be effective is by bringing people together. We have a very, very diverse state. And we don't need more people out there fighting for this or fighting for that. We need people working hard, bringing people together and delivering results. And if you look at the major things that I've worked on, whether it was major tax reform, two different rounds, the coalitions that came together to support those major rounds of tax reform looked radically different one from another. And because there were different issues and different people came together to solve the problems. And then but it's autism insurance reform and mental health reform, criminal justice reform. You know, all of these different areas where I've worked, it was only possible to make headway because people came together. When we can find ways to do that, go out of our way to do that, to be intentional about understanding where another person comes from, we'll have better results.
Paul Egan of the Detroit Free Press described the race you're in, and I'm quoting him here, one of the fiercest and downright nastiest gubernatorial campaigns in recent Michigan history. If you don't win the nomination August 7th, would you have any reservations about endorsing the winning candidate?
First of all, I'm going to win. Second of all, yeah, when it comes right down to it, when I look across the field, the issues on with the Democrats and the issues with the Republicans and overall, all four Republicans are better than all three Democrats, in my opinion.
Well, as far as for the nomination, so would you have any reservations about endorsing the winning GOP candidate?
Yeah, the winning, that'll be easy because I'm going to be the winner.
Okay.
But when it comes down to it, I think that regardless of who comes out of the GOP primary, that that you look at the issues and the record, that they're all stronger and better and they're in a better direction than all the Democrats are proposing.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
There are some classic campfire stories that we hear again and again. Stories like Bloody Mary or The Hitchhiker. Then there are stories unique to the place they're told, stories drawing on the history of the camp where they take place, where a long-lost camper or escaped madman is roaming around your lake, where the ghosts mentioned just might be lurking in your cabin. And that's the kind of tale we have for you today, as told by Jay Berry from Interlochen Center for the Arts.
My name is Jay Berry, and I am the manager for instrument services at the Interlochen Center for the Arts. Well, the story I'm going to be telling is the story of the Corson Auditorium ghost. And a little bit of background is back in the day, it was about 25 years ago, 30 years ago almost, I was a practice supervisor at Interlochen, and I didn't have a car. And so my friend and I would always make friends with people who had cars, and in this case, it was the boys on stage crew. So one night we were waiting for them to take us to the beach. And so we were watching them do a light hang. Watching people do a light hang is akin to watching people mow the grass. Really, really boring. And so we were just sitting there in the seats, and the time was passing, and it was getting later and later. And we were just sitting there watching him do this light hang. And then out of nowhere, he says, "I'm hanging lights, and I'll be done in a minute." And my friend and I looked at each other, and we said, "Yeah, we've been watching you for about 3 hours now. We were hoping you'd pick up the pace so we could get to the beach tonight, like before dawn." And he said, "No, I'm not talking to you." And we said, "Okay, who are you talking to?" And he said, "I'm talking to Margaret." "All right, we're the only ones here, and neither of our names are Margaret. Who are you talking to?" And he said, "I'm talking to the Corson ghost." So, of course, we got up and left, because who wants to drive to the beach with a crazy person, right? So, flash forward to about 10 years later, it's my first full year working at the Arts Academy. It's after honors combo. It's about 11:30 on a Friday night, the night before graduation, and I'm collecting instruments, and I'm trying to find an E-flat clarinet. I cannot find this E-flat clarinet. And I am pacing back and forth backstage in Corson, looking for the E-flat clarinet. And I keep hearing sounds. Usually around here, it's a mouse or a chipmunk that you hear, but I keep hearing sounds. And I keep thinking it's my friends coming back to help me, but they're hiding from me. So getting a little agitated, a little irritable, I'm very tired. I just want to find this E-flat clarinet. So finally I decide, oh, the heck with it. I don't care about the E-flat clarinet anymore. So I turn to leave, and I hear a woman's voice right by my right ear say, "What are you doing?" And I whipped around because I thought it was my friend Mary, and nobody was there. So I thought, okay, It's late. Let's just go. Let's just call it a night. Forget about the E-flat clarinet. And I turn around to go to the exit door again, and I hear this woman's voice right by my right ear say, "What are you doing?" And I thought, oh my God, this is the ghost. This is the Corson ghost. This is Margaret. And I said, "I'm looking for an E-flat clarinet, and I'll leave as soon as I find it." And I turned around to run, and I tripped over the E-flat clarinet. So we don't know who she is. We don't know where she came from. No one has ever died in Corson. But she's a very helpful ghost. And every now and again, if you're looking for something, you hear a woman's voice say, "What are you doing?"
That campfire story came from Jay Berry from Interlochen Center for the Arts. And that's our program for today, which was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.